Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Shackman. In all of the overblown coverage of this year's campaign, with all the hyperbolic talk of immigration policy, even among those who try and talk seriously about public policy, it's always easy to forget that real flesh and blood human beings and their lives are at the heart of the debate, and that more than 2.1 million children's lives are in limbo as a result of our failed immigration policy and the often misguided response. This is our focus today as I'm joined by my guest, Roberto Gonzalez. He's an assistant professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education. His work has been featured in the American Sociological Review and Current Anthropology, as well as in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, and the Wall Street Journal. He's the author of a new book entitled Lives in Limbo, Undocumented and Coming of Age in America. Roberto Gonzalez, thanks for joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why.
Well, Jeff, thanks for having me.
In all the current debate about immigration, have we lost sight of this whole issue of the children of undocumented immigrants and the whole issue of dreamers, which were so central for some time in our discussion?
Yeah, I think that what we certainly in this election cycle, we've been bombarded with really kind of negative messages about immigrants. And so I think that on the one hand, I think that advocates are finding themselves in a kind of defensive mode. And then I think that on the other hand, we've got a president who during his administration has deported upwards of 2.5 million immigrants. And so I think that these issues have really kind of grabbed headlines, and we've lost sight of these circumstances, a very sizable population of young people who grow up in this country and start hitting dead ends at around 15, 16, 17 years old when they can't move forward.
Talk a little bit about that, and specifically, because I think this never gets covered in the debate, what happens to these kids at 15, 16 years old? What do they go through? What do they encounter? How does this play out for them in very real ways?
Yeah, so this is a really good question, Jeff, and thank you for asking. So undocumented children, because of a Supreme Court ruling in 1982 in a case called Plyler versus Doe, have a right to a K-12 education. The court ruled that states could not deny these children access to a K-12 education. So as such, from day one in this country, they're integrated into a powerfully Americanizing institution where they grow up side by side with American-born peers and friends. They have a daily Pledge of Allegiance. Their teachers teach them lessons on American civics. They internalize ideals of democracy and meritocracy. They kind of in lockstep with their peers, they grow up to Barney and the Power Rangers. They date, they socialize, they go to prom, they do all of the things that their peers are doing. But at around 15, 16, 17 years old, as their friends are getting summer jobs or after school jobs, as their friends are getting work driver's permits and getting their driver's licenses, as they're starting to think about college and getting financial aid for college, these young people find themselves on the outside looking in. They find themselves stuck as their friends are moving forward. They have no choice but to watch, and this is very debilitating for many of these young people who, really kind of grow up to these messages by their teachers that if they work hard enough, if they dream boldly enough, that there will be something for them. But as they prepare themselves, as they ready for themselves to take that step into late adolescence and early adulthood, they find that they're unable. That they're unable to participate in really defining rites of passage.
And how do they relate to each other in the context of what you're talking about? This is not a situation where there's one or two or three. I mean, this is a whole group of students. And how does their interaction among themselves play out within this context?
Yeah, this is a really good question. I think that there are probably two answers to this, and I think that if we follow what I've been talking about in terms of the K-12 experiences, largely many of these young people don't disclose this big secret. So, you know, this is something for many of these young people, they only really discover that they don't have status at around 15, 16, 17 years old. Most of their childhood doesn't require any form of legality, and so they're not required to produce their birth certificate. They're not required to produce their social security number. As a result, many of them don't have knowledge of this. Certainly, many of them don't have these kinds of conversations with their friends. As they're moving into kind of a life of limitation, they're also moving into this highly stigmatized status, and that of the undocumented immigrant, in the pejorative, that of the illegal alien, quote unquote. And so many of these young people spend much of their later childhood, much of their later school years, keeping this secret and in silence, and keeping this secret from their friends, from other peers, from their teachers. This is a situation for many of them that, you know, for many of their families, their parents instruct them to, you know, you don't air your dirty laundry to strangers. You don't talk about issues of poverty or status or other kind of limitation. So many of these young people then end up having to carry out this story, and as a result have to explain to their friends why they're not taking a class field trip, or why they're on the bus instead of driving, why they're not going to their dream school, why they had to turn down this great work opportunity. But over the years, what we've seen is that many of these young people, very small portion of these young people are able to find their way to college campuses, that many of them have found empowerment and certainly strength and resources in numbers. Since probably about 2006, there's been a real kind of grassroots organizing, and many of these kind of dreamer groups have cropped up in communities and college campuses around the country. And so many of these young people have found very liberating the process of what they call coming out and disclosing their status and getting support not only from teachers and other adults, but from their community, from other young people who are experiencing the very same kinds of legal limitations and stress.
Is there any anger that manifests itself among these dreamers? And if so, who are they angry at?
Yeah, this is a really good question, Jeff. And I think that a lot of the anger, I think that it certainly ebbs and flows, but certainly at around this discovery period in late adolescence, when they realize that what they believed to be their future was not going to happen for them, many of them turn towards their teachers and to their parents. And many of the young people that I talked with in my book told me that they felt as though that they had been lied to. They felt betrayed. They felt as though they had bought into a kind of vision for their life that really wasn't true for them. And so in some cases, the young people that I spoke to, a couple cases, left home. One young woman left her home to live on her own and spent her college years really struggling to make ends meet, going to school for one semester at a time and not returning to home. I think that many of these young people eventually reconciled, particularly with their parents, coming to understand for them the kind of their parents' sacrifice and appreciating what their parents had done to bring them to this country. But I think that certainly in that kind of height of adolescence, when they're kind of experiencing this really kind of dramatic limiting, dramatic kind of collision, where they really, as I put it in the book, where they must learn to be quote unquote illegal.
Does it lead to political activism for any of them?
Yeah. So this has been the story, I think, over the last few years, that I think that this movement of undocumented young people has been one of the most impressive social movements of our time, and many of these young people have engaged in political activism. Many of them have become very visible. You look at two of the Democratic presidential candidates. Bernie Sanders hired two high-profile Dreamers to their campaign, and Hillary Clinton hired another as her Latino outreach person. These young people have been able to, in really important ways, move from these small Dreamer groups in their communities and on campus to what became a very coordinated national movement of young people advocating for themselves, tired of waiting for Congress and other people to make make decisions on their futures, and really wanting to take their future into their own hand. But I also must point out that a very small fraction of these young people, probably about 10%, successfully move from high school to college. And so what we see in terms of this Dreamer movement are, you know, is a smaller group of the population that's been able to successfully get to college campuses, and who have had the kind of time and the ability to collectively organize.
Is there anything that's the equivalent of, and I don't know a better phrase to use, a kind of survivor guilt among those that are able to make it onto college campuses and get through all the problems we've been talking about and succeed when they see their fellow Dreamers, many of whom are kind of left behind?
Yeah, well, this is, I think, a really important question, and I think that this has manifested itself most in many of the successful Dreamers' kind of guilt or their advocacy for their parents. Many years ago, early 2000s, the Dream Act was introduced in 2001, and many advocates, Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois and others, really helped to move the public opinion on this issue by presenting this narrative of the young, innocent child who was brought to the U.S. through no fault of her or his own, but despite the insurmountable odds, managed to become a class president, high school valedictorian, star athlete, star student, star citizen within their community. And this gained a lot of traction, and I think that it was really successful in helping to push, helping to move public opinion, helping to land this issue, high profile endorsements from Bill Gates, from presidents of universities. But many felt that this was a narrative that painted these, by contrast, young, innocent kids and their law-breaking parents. And so many of these young people, particularly as they grew older, and I think as their kind of social movement matured, many of them stopped telling this narrative and really embraced a more kind of holistic image or vision for immigrant families in this country, and as many of these young people said, they didn't want to, quote unquote, sell out their parents so that they could get some sort of special attention.
Which really raises the question of whether or not it's possible to fix one part of this problem without addressing the larger framework, that we can focus on the dreamers and come up with solutions for them, but it's really hard to imagine that being a true success without addressing the larger issues.
Yeah, well, I think this is where the present movement is at somewhat of an impasse. And I think the reality is that these young people belong to families and communities that in 2016 are desperate for some sort of relief. And so since 2012, we have on program on the books, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, and some 700,000 young people have benefited from this administrative action. They've received temporary social security numbers, 2-year renewable work permits, stays of deportation, and these young people are taking giant steps towards the American mainstream. But many of them continue to struggle, and they continue to struggle because they're one member in their family that now in some cases, you know, many of these young people, because their parents don't have driver's licenses, because their parents are still in low-wage jobs, are driving parents to and from work. They're taking on larger shares of work and responsibilities for paying household expenses. And so without the ability of their family members to also advance, many of these young people continue to face hardship, even though they have some form of access.
Talk a little bit about how institutions like universities are looking upon this and how they're trying to deal with it.
So this is really an issue that I think that the university that the most squarely has kind of come out in kind of as the kind of biggest institutional advocate in some cases. Many university presidents have stepped forward and endorsed a pathway to legalization for these young people. Some 18 universities now provide, some 18 states rather provide in-state tuition at their public universities for undocumented students. Four universities have passed bills, or four states have passed bills to allow undocumented students to compete for state financial aid. And so in some places, undocumented young people, some places, universities have kind of leveled the field for undocumented students. On the other hand, states like South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Arizona have excluded undocumented students from in-state tuition. And in other cases have excluded undocumented immigrant students from admission to their universities. And so we see today a real kind of mixed landscape at the level of higher education, whereby place matters. And so where one lives matters a whole lot in terms of access to higher education.
Talk a little bit about those that get through the system of higher education and what happens after that, even if they're able to navigate that.
Well, I think that this is the really kind of central issue, I think, affecting many of these young people. And so in my book, I follow a group of very high achievers and a group of young people who left high school or left school at or before the high school graduation. And so you see at early ages, at 17, 18 years old, their trajectories diverge greatly, where some young people are entering into 2- and 4-year colleges. They remain optimistic about their futures, and others at 17, 18 years old are entering low-wage labor market, are working in, finding work in factories, doing landscaping, cleaning houses, other kind of low-wage immigrant jobs. By their mid to late 20s, when many of the college-bound young people started running out of options for school, they had several dozen in my study had obtained college degrees, 4-year degrees, and a few of them even went on to post baccalaureate programs, law school, master's in education programs, public policy programs, public health. But we see that these trajectories start to converge significantly, whereby even those with a college degree as of 2012 had the same range of options as those who had left school years earlier, many of whom didn't graduate from high school. But here they were with the same very limited range of options for work and adult participation in adult life more generally.
To what extent do you think that the dialogue, from what you're hearing, from what you sense from talking to these young people, that the dialogue will come back around to focusing once again on the plight of these dreamers?
Well, I think that it's really critical that it does. And so in the President's State of the Union address, he laid out a plan for the future, and I think that indeed much of the coverage on immigration and the kind of national discourse on immigration has been kind of focused on present and future. What do we do? What do we do about this? But I think that there's an urgent need to tell the story of the last 15 years, to tell the kind of deeper story of the real kind of carnage suffered over the last decade and a half due to failed efforts, failed congressional efforts of passing an immigration bill. And I think also what Stanford political scientist Gary Segura has called enforcement on steroids. This administration has deported upwards of 2.5 million people. And so the young people in my book, many of the young people who in 2001, when the DREAM Act was first introduced, were the poster children for a DREAM Act. So they were young, they were innocent, they were high achieving. But here they are now, many of them in their early 30s. And over time, the strains of low-wage work and the stresses of kind of living their lives in limbo have taken a toll. And this has had long-term consequences in their lives. Their hands now bear calluses or joint pain. Their backs and knees ache. Their stress has turned into frustration and in a lot of cases, depression. And many of these young people have put a lid on hope. And so there's an urgent need, I think, that if we want to think about the implications of providing education to a large settled group of young people and really teaching them that if you work hard, if you dream boldly enough, that there's something there for you, that only years later for them to hit dead ends, this is a big problem for our country. This is, if you think about this from a public policy perspective, from a public health perspective, that, you know, this is an issue that impacts not only these young people, it impacts their families, it impacts communities, it impacts our really kind of the lifeblood of this country.
And finally, is there a difference in terms of where these young people come from? Are those that come from Mexico versus those that come from places in Central America treated differently, dealing with different issues?
Yeah, well, I think that certainly over the last several years, and I think that it's been amped up in this election cycle, that the focus or the target has really been on immigrants of Latin American origin. Mexicans and Central Americans, whereby much of the heat, much of the rhetoric, much of the our enforcement efforts are targeted to Latin American communities, and so this has had real life consequences in terms of families being broken apart and kids losing parents, and it's also had a chilling effect across the country, as many Latino immigrants, Mexican and Central American young people and their families fear that taking a walk in a park, waiting at a bus station, even being at one's house, right, could end up in apprehension, detention, and eventual deportation.
Roberto Gonzalez. Roberto, I thank you so much for spending time with us here on Radio Who, What, Why.
Jeff, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you'll join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shekman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share it and help other people find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.